From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Let's get one thing straight. Robot warriors are not science fiction, and they don't talk like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Robots have been in the world's arsenals for years now. Mostly, they're remote controlled by humans. But as computers get smaller and smarter, as warfare gets faster than the blink of a human eye, the temptation, some might say the imperative, to design lethal machines that decide for themselves when and where to fire, to destroy, is huge. They are being designed now. Swarming boats, swarming drones, radar blasters, some are already deployed. This hour on Point, delegating the decision to kill to machines. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you see this coming? Soldiers, engineers, what do you think? What have you seen? And for all, can we, should we, block this path of what activists are calling robot killer robots? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. There are all kinds of things that people are pointing to out there already. Let's listen to a couple right here. It depends on your definition when something is an autonomous war robot, I guess. Israel has, for example, its Harpy system. It sold it to China, South Korea, India, Turkey, Chile. It's an unmanned aircraft armed with a warhead. It flies in groups, it seeks out enemy radar, and flies into it kamikaze style.
Multiple Harpies are deployed to autonomously suppress and destroy the enemy radar systems in a wide area. Harpy operates in day, night, and severe weather conditions and does not require precise intelligence data.
Okay, you get the picture. Or here's another. In this video released by the U.S. Navy Research last fall, October 2014, an official with the Office of Naval Research describes the possibility that he sees in an autonomous swarm, technology at sea.
The idea of controlling small boats that are not only unmanned, but they're able to have machine perception. They're able to perceive things without a human being in the loop. And then they're able to make decisions, which in this context means planning their route or planning their action. That can be a game changer because that opens up a whole new set of missions that can be done without a human on board that asset.
Or here, not autonomous, but up there on the borderline, the Swords Talon, a weaponized remote control robot deployed for the U.S. Army in 2007. Three of these units, armed with M249 machine guns, were deployed to Iraq. The first time robots carried guns into battle. And here's a little bit from the Military Channel video. Army Sergeant Jason Moreau, who works on developing military technology, explains this robot's role in an ambush situation. Then it fires at targets.
If you walk into an ambush site, I'd prefer to have the robot go up first, hopefully attract the fire. That way we can actually utilize the robot to identify the enemy and assist in elimination.
There is a conference this week at the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland. It's got the dry title, Meeting of Experts on Lethal Autonomous Weapons Systems. But hear those words, lethal, autonomous. We'll go to that meeting in Geneva in just a minute, but first, for some background, Patrick Tucker is technology editor at Defense One. He joins us from Washington. Patrick Tucker, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Killer Robots is a real head-turning title. Is that where we're headed? Are we in some ways there?
Well, this is a topic of great sensitivity to the United States military, which doesn't like the idea of their increasingly capable, lethal robotic weapon systems being called killer robots. And what they emphasize when you talk to them over and over again is that they are dedicated to living in accordance with the 2012 Defense Department policy directive that says a person must always be on the loop when the question is whether or not a machine can select a target and engage that target. So the person has to select what target is going to be engaged kinetically. Now, that leaves a lot of room for increasingly capable autonomous, semi-autonomous, slightly autonomous systems to do more and more stuff, like seek out other drones and fire at them, employ non-lethal effects like sound or smoke or something like that to sort of startle or dazzle an enemy, light, that sort of thing. So there's an increasing increasing need for these systems to do more and more stuff. But when it comes to that big red line of allowing a robot to select and then engage a human target, this is the line that they say they're definitely not going to cross. And so they'll emphasize this over and over again. We're not going to make what many, I don't know, might call a killer robot, but they are going to make robots that are very capable of doing a lot more stuff.
But we're coming right up to that line. And, of course, the U.S. won't be the last word on this, or the only player in this arena. And they're are a lot of strategic pressures mounting here, a lot of interest. People are writing about weapons that are out there already. What is pushing militaries and non-state actors in this direction, Patrick?
Well, a couple of years ago, the number of different countries that were pursuing the development of armed UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, or what we call drones, was really minor. And now it's about 23, and that's only going to increase. And that's because what it offers you is the opportunity to have like an Air Force on the cheap. Basically, you can really increase the capability of a very small Air Force operation, or the lack of an Air Force operation, by with basically what is consumer technology that's been hacked or modified in some way to become more dangerous. So what's pushing it is that, especially with the United States military as well, big planes, big fighter jets are expensive. The cost of our most advanced fighter jet, the one that we're working on right now, the F-35, which has different components. There's an F-35A and F-35B, different mods of it. This thing costs, according to GAO in March, about $180 million a plane. The maker, Lockheed Martin, says, actually, we're getting it down to more like $70 million a plane. If you factor in, you know, how we're going to, you know, reach economies of scale and stuff like that, that's outrageous. Expensive. These things, our most advanced drones are about $14 million a pop, and you can go down the street to Radio Shack and you can pick one up for much cheaper than that. That's just sort of like of a consumer variety. So you're going to be able to realize effects that you know you can't with conventional jets and stuff like that. This is what's pushing this. Just economies of scale are enormous.
What about strategic competition? This issue of speed, as the speed of combat rises, maybe beyond human response times.
That's certainly an aspect of it. Right now we have the UAVs that we employ in places like Iraq and Syria to do airstrikes against ISIL targets. They, for the most part, have two operators behind them. And so it's kind of like these guys are flying a plane. But the push for autonomy is to allow operators to do a lot more and just allow that entire process to happen much faster. So that is something that factors into Pentagon thinking about how to develop these things and where to put your autonomy money going forward. It's not so much about – they're not in a mad rush to engage more targets super quickly. So we have these ideas about like sort of like the speed of war and how fast it is. At the same time, if you talk to the Pentagon, what they're most interested in, their watchwords, are actually in allowing particular staff to be much more capable, decreasing like the costs of staff and allowing these systems to respond quicker. But that doesn't necessarily mean engaging every target faster. That's not actually a big gap that we're seeing. We can engage a lot of targets really quickly.
But if you're trying to push toward one operator, one human operator, maybe operating a half dozen or a dozen or more drones at one time, you can see where the urge to autonomy might come in here. If we sort of follow the breadcrumbs of different weapons, different equipment that's already out there or on the drawing boards, where do you see the particular examples that are pushing up toward this frontier of lethal, autonomous weapon systems?
Well, there's a couple of different examples from around the world, as we sort of brought up in the beginning of the show. The Israeli defense contractors have a machine called the Harpy, and it is very much at the cutting edge of what is autonomous. It does not aim at people. It aims at radar systems, but it can select targets on its own and engage targets on its own. It's got an override capacity, so like the person that sent the Harpy out on its mission can detonate or turn the machine off in air, but the Harpy selects a target and engages a target. That's it does it selects Flex radar, but it's that's doing a lot of thinking right there. The United States has a program that they're funding through Northrop Grumman, one of our big defense contractors, the X-47B. This is, in terms of U.S. drones, very much the height of autonomous capability. And next week, actually, it's going to demonstrate its ability, I'm told. We'll see if it actually does this, but they wouldn't be announcing this if they weren't pretty confident in it. Its ability to refuel in air. So essentially, you've got a highly capable combat drone that doesn't have to land except for maintenance, can just stay up there all the time. And this is something that a jet with a human in it can't do, can't stay up there on those long missions the same way that a drone can. And it can find targets. It's not going to engage those targets without human guidance, but it can do a whole lot of stuff on its own in terms of understanding its situation, in terms of perhaps even communicating with other drones that are alongside of it. And that's another thing that they're actually pushing is getting more and more of these systems to cooperate with one another, creating amongst them a network, a highly capable network, in this, what we call a swarm, that is going to engage enemies and potential adversaries in an overwhelming way. So sort of surrounding and operating in concert in a way that's really uncanny and strange. The last August, the Office of Naval Research, part of the Navy, demonstrated some remarkable capabilities here on a river. They had 13 boats that were, as mentioned, nearly autonomous. They performed a series of extremely difficult maneuvers. They astounded like a lot of people in the amount of thinking that these ships were doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the dawn of lethal autonomous weapons systems, or as some would have it, killer robots, and the effort to keep the genie in the bottle to slow or halt the march toward robot war. It's on the agenda right now in Geneva at a big UN meeting there. It's on in labs, too, the push to develop autonomous weaponry that could hypothetically, maybe not so hypothetically, kill on its own. It's one called Taranis. It's an unmanned warplane developed by British Aerospace Engineering Systems, designed to carry a variety of weapons and use stealth technology. Unmanned. Flew for the first time in 2013. Here's a little sound of that in flight. The U.S. has its own direction here. F-35C, new American jet designed for landings on aircraft carriers. Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus says it is the last manned strike fighter aircraft the Department of the Navy will ever fly. But it lands on the bucking deck of an aircraft carrier with zero help from a pilot already. It's got 24 million lines of code built in to do that. Here it is in its final stages of testing last November, landing on the deck of the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz. As a pilot, the pilot's not doing the landing. And the Navy Secretary says, no more. We're going to go unmanned here. Patrick Tucker is with us. He's technology editor at Defense One. They've been paying a lot of attention to what's going on in this arena. I want to go to Geneva, Switzerland, where the UN meeting is underway this week, and a couple of very plugged-in people there. Paul Shari joins us from Geneva. He's director of the 20YY Warfare Initiative and the Ethical Autonomy Project, both at the Center for a New American Security, bipartisan defense think tank in Washington. He's in Geneva this week speaking at the Meeting of Experts on Lethal Autonomous Weapons Systems, the title of his presentation, Technical Issues in Autonomous Weapons. Paul Shari, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
And with us from Geneva is Noel Sharkey. He's Professor Emeritus of Robotics and Artificial Intelligence at the University of Sheffield in Britain, and he's Chairman of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control, which is why he's also attending the meeting this week at the UN. Noel Sharkey, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. Good to be on the show.
Paul Shari, can you describe some of the trends that are pushing weaponry in this direction?
Well, I think the basic issue, Tom, is, you know, we're seeing autonomy be incorporated into more different kinds of technologies, whether it's your phone, self-driving cars, Twitter bots, and militaries are definitely investing in autonomy as well for all of the reasons that Patrick outlined earlier. The key question is how much? How much autonomy? What's the role of human control? Are there some things that certainly autonomous systems could not do? And then are there other issues where maybe even if autonomous system could do it well, it shouldn't. A person should do those things. And so there have been a lot of discussions here this week at Geneva about autonomous weapons. No country is saying they are building them, but there's still quite a bit of confusion, I would say, about exactly what we're talking about here.
Do you see a push in this direction? Do you think there will be a treaty to stop this drift, if it's a drift?
So this particular venue, the United Nations Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, does not really have a great track record for success. It's a consensus-based institution, and so it only takes one state to say no, and nothing really happens. And what we've seen, kind of the pattern in the past, with previous weapons issues that have arisen, things like landmines and cluster munitions, is that this institution will discuss them, and activist groups will raise these concerns. But eventually, there won't be any action, and activist groups will go out on their own and create their own treaty like they did with landmines and cluster munitions. So it's kind of too early now to say exactly what will happen. We certainly won't have a treaty by the end of the week, by Friday, but it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds over the next year.
Noel Sharkey, you're there in Geneva with a lot of red flags raised. What's the direction of weapons development that has you concerned here, Noel?
Well, I've been pretty much concerned about them since I first read about them in 2006. I'd read a lot of roadmaps from the US, and in those days they were talking about autonomy in a much more gung-ho way. There's lots of interviews you can find on YouTube with generals saying how they will have weapons that will go out and kill people without any human involvement. But recently, the DoD directive, which I know that Paul here was the director of that directive, and he organized it. They're saying that they will have appropriate levels of judgment. But I've seen quite a lot of developments, and I'm quite worried about proliferation throughout the world. I mean, it's not just the US. You mentioned the Harpy. There's also Israel. There's also South Korea. The UK, as you mentioned as well, and Russia are already deploying autonomous robot sentries around their nuclear installations. So if there's a will, this can go forward. And it's all very well to talk about appropriate levels of control. But, you know, what does that really mean? And how will that shift over time?
We're looking at the development of faster and faster weapons. Does that somehow propel lethal autonomous weaponry, Noel?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, people keep saying one of the big motivations is that the battlefield is becoming too fast for human decision making. And really, my own personal view is, well, you know, what's the big hurry to kill more people? Just slow it down a bit. But because the thing is, when you get fast, other people have to get faster, then you have to get faster, and so on. So that creates a kind of instability. And so this accelerating pace of battle. But the other thing that really worries me, and Paul may talk about this as well, it's the idea that when it's okay thinking about a short-term advantage. You know, the United States is losing its dominance in the missile field, I believe, and it might get some dominance in autonomous weapons for a while. But then other people have them. And when people are talking about having swarms, as Paul often does, and other people, then another country can have these swarms as well. Now, how will they interact? Now, myself as a computer scientist, and any computer scientist on the planet will tell you, when you have algorithms or computer programs that are unknown, and don't forget, nobody's going to reveal what their combat program is. When you have two sets of programs that are unknown, it's scientifically unpredictable what will happen. And if that's happening at very high speed, I don't know. I mean, we're talking about the future now, but we're looking. I mean, the thing to do is to think about, where is this taking us eventually? Are we moving to another step in the Industrial Revolution? Are we moving to the full industrialization of warfare? Are we moving to warfare that's fully automated? I'm not talking about tomorrow, but this is the first step towards that, and it really concerns me.
Professor Sharkey, could you unpack that a little bit for we lay people out here? When you talk about algorithms and weaponry, and if I understood you correctly, you're picturing lethal autonomous weaponry on both sides of a conflict, each equipped or coded with algorithms that would determine its targeting and its firing, their targeting and firing. And what's the dynamic you're concerned about there?
Let's
sounds pretty
example.
Concerning on its face, but take us into it.
Okay, let's take an example of simple example of a robot weapon or an autonomous weapon that's going to attack a target. Now, when it's getting there, you might think it might meet other aircraft that are trying to attack it. So what you'll put on board is a means for fighting back. That will be a computer program that might say, if you see, I mean, let me be very simple. If you see a jet on your left, duck underneath or fly towards the sky, or one of it'll be various maneuvers that will be programmed in as it goes towards its target. There'll be various countermeasures waiting for it. Now, if the other person will have also, the other side will also have these programs for combat. Now, we don't know how, at high speed, how they're going to interact with each other. If you imagine a static target, that's quite easy. But a dynamic target that's moving very fast with its own program, anything can happen whatsoever. In fact, I have no idea what will happen.
Paul Shari, can we really imagine having sufficient target identification, the technology that would be so sophisticated that a machine could successfully identify a target without a human over its shoulder, with adequate certainty to fire and destroy?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on how comfortable you are with risk and what adequate means. I think certain countries could take very different positions on that. When you talk about, say, a person, that's very hard to imagine. I mean, in sort of the today's modern battlefield, you might put different people in the exact same situation, and they come to different conclusions about what's right and what's wrong. But against, say, an enemy radar that's sending out signals in the electromagnetic environment, that Israeli heartbeat that was on the show earlier does it today. And so some targets are easier than others. Now, is that a good idea? That's another question. But is it technically possible? Some things are definitely possible today.
Patrick Tucker in Washington, Paul and Noel are in Geneva, where this is under a magnifying glass. This issue of command and control and the potential disruption of electromagnetic fields, which could disrupt command and control. Mm-hmm. I'm reading here, this is one of the things that may push people toward lethal and autonomous. Because if we've seen this picture in recent decades, the military is kind of infatuated with the idea of all kinds of electronic weaponry, remote control, doing all kinds of things. But if you manage to put some pulse in there or disruption in that command and control, radio signals, electromagnetic field, then if you don't have some autonomous weapons out there, you're shut down. If the other guy has autonomous weapons that keep on fighting, they're not shut down.
Right, exactly. And that really speaks to one of the big thrusts for further development of autonomy in these systems is the military as an institution, one must be careful in making, broad statements about an institution that is as large and as diverse and has as many points of view as the United States military. It's a country in and of itself. But as an institution, you can say they like control. These guys are kind of control guys. So they like the ability to control what the drone is doing as it's undergoing different operations, as it's doing maneuvers, as it's trying to carry out a mission on behalf of a human operator. But all of that interaction that has to happen between the operator and the drone, that's a vulnerability. It's the same thing as sort of like a supply line vulnerability, but in this instance, the thing that's being supplied is information. It's coming over satellite. Depending on the model, it's coming over Bluetooth or radio. And that can be disrupted. It can be jammed. It can be potentially hacked. Now, the United States government spends a lot of money to make sure that the signals that determine the piloting for the drones that we use in combat are really safe. But we also acknowledge all of the time that we are at war on the electromagnetic spectrum. It is a new area of war for us. It's a really crowded spectrum. And it's just all of the electrons that we send out all of the time now, except in the context of battle. So if you can decrease the amount of communication that happens between an operator and a drone, then you're going to have a far more resilient system. It's going to be far less vulnerable to that sort of interception, to jamming, to just basic mishaps.
And in other words, the more autonomy the drone has, the less vulnerable you are to the disruption of command and control, the signal.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. And so your supply line. And this is part of the reason, like, the Army is looking for drones in the first place, is actually just to resupply stuff. And so this is another aspect of that. If the greater level of autonomy you can wire into your system, the greater the resilience to hacking or jamming or any other of those disruption effects.
Paul Shari in Geneva, I wonder if this is where military, I mean, you were involved in 2012 with this directive saying humans have to be in the loop, and you were under Ash Carter, who was undersecretary at that time, I believe. Of course, he's now Secretary of Defense. And the red line drawn there is that, you know, you have to have human involvement when it comes to target selection, firing. But is there some inexorable logic here that draws militaries toward more autonomy? Because you have to say, well, what if command and control is cut off and the other guy has weapons that keep on going, picking targets well or poorly, but they keep on going and keep on firing killer robots, whatever you want to call them. We've got to have them too.
Well, certainly that what Pat mentioned, sort of the ability to operate if you lose communications, that's one potentially, and speed. As you talked about earlier, that accelerating pace of battle, those are pressures that could drive militaries to want these kinds of weapons. Now, no one has said that they're building them, but that potential is there. But there are also military vulnerabilities in each of those. So as you incorporate more autonomy, the downside is that it increases the potential consequences if someone does hack your system. So if you were to hack into the control links of a Predator UAV today, you would be very hard-pressed to control that aircraft because it actually is flown remotely with a stick and rudder by a person sitting in a cockpit here in the United States. So you'd have to replicate all of those controls. But if you had an autonomous vehicle, then maybe you could just insert some malware, a computer virus that might, say, change its higher-level instructions, tell it to attack friendly forces, and then the consequences could be quite severe. And similarly with speed, there's this danger that this pace of battle moves so quickly that you don't have control over your own forces anymore. And I think, you know, as was pointed out earlier, military commanders, at least in the United States, are not interested in weapons they cannot control. They want to keep very tight control over their weapons. But there is that inherent tension there.
Noel Sharkey, it's asserted there that people are not working on this, but a whole lot of work that I see described here seems to come right up to the edge of this and maybe arguably into it, lethal autonomous.
Well, I think that people are working on it quite a lot. But one of the really big problems for people working on this is the idea of compliance with the laws of war. And that's very difficult under many circumstances. I think Paul can give you some circumstances where they could comply in a limited way. But the idea that we could have these things fielded on a battlefield, because they could not at the moment. I mean, I'm a professor of robotics. Determine the difference between a civilian and a combatant or a wounded soldier or a surrendering soldier. And that's a really major problem. If they can't do that, it's no good. But that doesn't mean that people won't use them. If lots of people develop these, spend billions of dollars developing them, and the United States can say all at once about appropriate levels of human control, but when other nations are coming at them and they've got a military advantage, then everything will change, like we saw with aerial bombardment.
Patrick, are we on that development path now without maybe crossing the red line entirely, but are we, you know, marching in that direction?
Well, I there's a certain inevitability to much of it, but it's not at all inevitable that we're going to create systems that do their own, like, really advanced level targeting. There's a lot still to be determined, and I think that as we go forward and we use these systems more, depending on the accidents that we get to see or the lack of accidents involving a programming, that's what's really going to make a big difference in how we proceed from there. If you don't see a lot of accidents, then you can see the brakes coming off in many ways, but not all.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the dawn of lethal autonomous weapon systems, what some are calling killer robots, and the effort to keep that genie in the bottle to slow or halt the march toward what could be a robot war. It's right now on the agenda in Geneva at a UN meeting there. It's in labs, too, though, pushing to develop more autonomous capacity that may one day kill on its own. People are saying, no, it's time to draw a deep, deep line in the sand here. Noel Sharkey is with us from the University of Sheffield in Britain, Professor Emeritus there. He's with the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. Some are calling it the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, saying, let's make this very clear right now. And you hear him already raising questions about whether it could possibly comply with the laws of war. Well, but we've seen how those are followed and ignored. Paul Shari is with us, director of the 20YY Warfare Initiative and the Ethical Autonomy Project at the Center for New American Security. Paul and Noel, both in Geneva for the UN conference. Patrick Tucker is with us, technology editor at Defense One. They're paying a lot of attention to this issue. Listeners responding in all kinds of ways here. John says worried on Facebook, says, no, salivating. Talk about an edge on our enemies. These battle bots can be programmed to seek and destroy all kinds of secondary targets, ammo dumps, fuel depots. The list goes on. John's into it. Many are not. Sylvie and others say scary. Everybody's raising issues about how do you bring any sense of ethics into this, and what about escalation if that's where it goes? Alan says, I'd be more concerned with hobby helicopters on the South Lawn, the gyro landing on the Capitol West Lawn there yesterday. Yeah, that turned a lot of heads. Let's hear from our listeners. Peter in Boston, thank you for calling, Peter. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. A great show. Listen, I think I have somewhat of a unique perspective. I've been an attorney 40 years, and I also have been a combat veteran in the Marine Corps and the infantry. I'm well aware of the Geneva Convention and rules of engagement. And first, the one thing I did support of President Obama was pulling the troops out. Unfortunately, the reality is, and there's no question, we need to keep scrutiny on the developments of these weapons, but let's talk reality. Reality is the American troops are back right now in Iraq. They're sending more special op advisors. Those drones are very helpful. And the bottom line comes down anytime you have American troops out there potentially to get killed, when you can have drones that can take and help eliminate casualties, I'm just appalled at the hubris of academics, professors, and Europeans who, number one, they're not fighting the war.
Hey, Peter, but what if you're on the battlefield and it's not controlled by a human? If it's autonomous, if it were programmed with the software, would you be comfortable as a soldier, as a grunt on the ground under that firepower?
Okay. Now, this isn't the Arnold Schwarzenegger where we have those robots control. No question, we're not at that stage. And absolutely, human control. And I think one of the experts was saying human control. I don't see that coming out of the loop for a long time.
Oh, a lot of people are thinking about exactly that, though. Even though that's the governing principle right now, the capacity to take it out
is just the hubris of all the people. Again, it has to be clearly looked at. But the Pope recently said a week ago, we need to do more about the Christians getting killed. No, what does that mean? What, you wave a cross at them? No, it means send more American troops over there to fight.
Peter, we've got it. Concern for the troops there. Who's going to do the fighting? And if some kind of drone will help, fine. But what if it's autonomous? What if you don't have humans making decisions about where the fire goes and when the fire comes? One more right here. Ray in Miami, Florida. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I'm concerned because I wonder what's going to happen when the drones turn on us. We've got drones right now killing us, people all over the world, particularly in Africa, where people are being slaughtered by drones. And for what? Democracy? Is that democracy? Is that freedom? I don't think so. And I think that, in my opinion, the only people who benefit from these wars are the rich and those who control our government and control the military and control the drones, and I think, and own the drones. And I think it's time for the American people or the people of goodwill around the world to wake up as to who is behind all of this. And because the people can do something about it, it is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but they just need to wake up and stop listening to all this propaganda that's put out to get them to kill people to take their land and their natural resources.
Ray, we've got the perspective, and I fully understand it. This can raise a lot of concerns, and I appreciate your call from Miami. One more, Louisville. Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well. What's up, Chris?
I'm calling from the Vex Robotics World Championship. There's actually 800 teams from all over the world, students from elementary school all the way through high school that are building robots that are competing. They actually have a 15-second autonomous period where the robots run on their own to accomplish certain tasks. So this is really like where it all begins.
A Robotics World Championship in Louisville? And who sponsors that competition, Chris?
The U.S. Army and also, I believe, NASA and a few other sponsors, but they're all very big sponsors. And U.S. Army is actually one of the really big sponsors here.
And you say the kids, these teenagers, are writing code that would enable autonomous robots. Can you see applications in a military direction?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is what is driving the youth of today to head into those related jobs in the government and other practical applications for robotics.
But if we're not going to cross a red line into lethal unmanned weapon systems, maybe that's going nowhere, Chris.
Well, you know, I think there's definitely some good positive use of the autonomous here, and what they're learning, you know, has benefits. But I definitely understand after listening to your show where you're coming from with the lethal autonomous robots.
Chris, at the Robotics World Championship there in Louisville with the U.S. Army as a big sponsor, and one more. We'll go to our guest George in Oklahoma City. George, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had one comment, one question. I find it ironic that in the pursuit of war and the killing of other humans, that we are increasingly trying to take humans out of the process. So I find that very ironic. And two, I just wonder if people have thought about the political ramifications in terms of dissenting from war. If the, you know, sometimes the loss of troops, not only in our country, but in many countries can lead people to make protesting against the war.
Yeah.
You know, a recent example would be the Iraq war. It wasn't into the mounting. I'm not for any human death, but, you know, deaths of your own people may cause you to second guess. Should we be doing this or not? And I just wonder if that's taken away and it's just robots, you know, what's the political cost that may cause leaders to question their decision?
Yeah, George, that's very interesting, and I appreciate your call from Oklahoma City. Paul Shari, I mean, there's another question along these lines on Twitter. Bettina says, if we use killer robots to fight other killer robots, will we end up with wars where nobody gets killed? I'm not sure how to look at this. Does sensitivity to the loss of troops drive us further in this direction, Paul, or does it put a brake on lethal autonomous weapon systems?
Well, certainly the military, not only the U.S. military, but most militaries who have this ability are looking to robots to help reduce risks. That's certainly one of the things that they can do. And there was a clip of the soldier on earlier talking about sending the robot out in front to get ambushed. And that makes a lot of sense. But that's not the same thing as whether or not a person gets to decide whether the robot fires and who it fires at. You can use drones or ground robots or robots at sea to give more distance to protect soldiers and not, you know, delegate to them the decision to use force. Those are not the same thing at all. And so certainly we'll see more military robotics, but this question of whether you sort of turn over the keys, if you will, for decisions about targeting and engagement is another issue entirely.
But if I'm still curious about how sensitivity about the loss of troops comes into that. If you were very concerned about losing troops in war, would you be more or less likely to turn over the decision to the robot?
I don't know that those really go together. I would say that has more to do with, say, if you believe you can have communications links. We certainly are using unmanned aircraft or drones today that are able to reduce risk to soldiers by not having soldiers on the ground. But a person is in control all of the time. And they can even, you know, abort the missile after it's launched. So those don't necessarily have to be the same thing.
I mean, Noel, I can imagine here that different moral equations could lead to different technical specifications and different applications here. If you're not as concerned about your own troops or about others, even if the software is not perfect, you could unleash it.
Well, I mean, as the commentator said, as George said there, we really don't want to see young men being killed on the battlefield. And I am a European professor, but I'm a UK professor, and there have been... friends of mine's children have been killed in Afghanistan, you know, paratroopers, etc. But having said that, if we use autonomous weapons, we're really going to a point where it might lower the threshold for going into conflict. It's the threat of body bags coming home can be a great inhibitor to warfare, because none of us want to see it, so we might have less wars. If we don't worry about that, then we could easily start having more warfare, more conflicts, more armed conflicts, persisting on the battlefield for long periods of time. These things give you a lot of persistence as well. So you go and take a place, then you leave them hovering for a very, very long time, threatening the population and, you know, giving them all sorts of stress. It's not nice to live under these devices.
Jeff's calling from Montpelier, Vermont. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just wondering how our intelligence has assessed our perceived enemies' work in this field, and is this really part of a new warfare normal in order to compete in warfare internationally?
I'm glad for your question, Jeff. Patrick Tucker in Washington, is there an arms race dynamic to this? Whatever the standing directive is, there's clearly more effort being put into autonomy. Could an arms race mindset or reality drive lots of people down this path?
Yeah, I would say so. Right now, we know of, like I said, 23 different countries that are attempting to attain armed drone capabilities. Not very many countries actually have them so far. UK has its own armed drones. Israel. There's some debate about whether or not China actually has one. They probably do. Russia's working very quickly to develop armed drones, and they also are real leaders in terms of developing drones for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So we imagine that they're going to make a leap into developing different varieties of armed drones very quickly, and they will probably show up, depending on how hostilities continue on the fields of eastern Ukraine before the year is out. Again, depending on how the situation there begins to
play
out.
But an armed drone is different than, say, an autonomous armed drone with lethal capacity.
Right. Well, and this is – so the same factors that push us to increase the level of autonomy would obviously just be the same for any country that is developing armed drones. You have the opportunity to cut down on staffing, to have one potential operator over a wider and wider network of different machines. And so, you know, the cost-benefit analysis works out the same for everybody. And then you're right, when you get down into the costs versus benefits of making automatic the both the targeting and the engagement decision, then you're dealing with a slightly different calculus. But the drive towards autonomy in these systems is the same as the drive to make armed drones in the first place. You're just going to get more bang out of your buck if the more capable and smart these machines are.
Patrick, the swarm dynamic you mentioned before, I'm looking here at headlines, one from your Defense One, the Navy preparing to launch swarm bots out of cannons. Another here,
yeah.
DARPA wants an army of drones to overwhelm the enemy. That sounds like some level of autonomy. But how does the swarm dynamic become appealing to military people?
Right, and this is – so when the military looks at how they're going to develop this stuff into the future, they look at two aspects. One is like this – it's really Paul that has written fantastically on this in a variety of different outlets. The when you've got a whole bunch of really cheap systems that can conduct maneuvers in a way that sort of like systems that are much larger, like a jet, can't, then you can achieve battlefield effects that really, in many ways, have never been seen on this planet before.
They're talking about and swarms of drones that might surround a big fighter jet or strike jet, like sort of a cloud of lethal gnats around the big killer in the middle.
You're right, or you know, continue to barrage a high value naval target like an aircraft carrier, and you can't shoot all of them down. And we're actually beginning to develop a lot of weird counteroffenses in anticipation of future swarm bots coming at stuff like our boats. Like, this is one of the big reasons why the Navy is developing a lot of high energy weapons, what we call lasers, because the cost that they're anticipating for shooting down swarms of cheap drones makes the use of some conventional ammunition sort of high. So they want these sort of laser cannon things that can fire it like a buck a shot, so they can shoot down all of the drones that they're anticipating in the future, which is, I mean, then you're just getting into like pure science fiction-y type stuff made real, is, you know, shooting down swarms of drones that are operating with one another with lasers. This is the stuff that we have to build now.
Made real, the phrase to look at there. Noel Sharkey, You referenced the laws of war. If you could lay down a new legal barrier internationally to this, what would it look like?
It would look like an international prohibition on any kind of autonomous weapon where the kill decision was not in human hands. Now, when we're talking about swarms here, it becomes very difficult to have a human in control.
And yet, that is what we're talking about here. A kind of dawn on the horizon, many hoping it goes no further than that, but you can hear some of the dynamics pushing for further development on this front in our conversation today. Noel Sharkey, Professor Emeritus in Robotics, Artificial Intelligence at the University of Sheffield in Britain with the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. Thank you so much for being with us today, Professor Sharkey.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Ours. Paul Shari, director of the 20YY Warfare Initiative at the Center of a New American Security for New American Security. Paul, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Patrick Tucker with Defense One. Thank you, Patrick.
Hey, thank you.
Listeners, thanks for all your insights. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.